You are Locked On Hawks, your daily Atlanta Hawks podcast. Part of the Locked On Podcast Network. Your team, every day.
Hello, friends, and welcome to episode 294 of the Locked On Hawks podcast. I am your host, Brad Roland, joining me for the first time in more than a month. It doesn't seem like that long, I suppose, but Chris Barnwell, CBS Sports. What's up, man?
What's up? How are you?
We're just living the dream. You and I are both working on this fine Monday night, as we do. But, you know, I figured it was time.
Working.
Yeah, working in quotation marks, of course.
Yeah,
This is actually your job. It's one of my jobs.
I mean, is it a job?
Yes. There are days when it's not as when it's a job. There are more days when it's not necessarily. You know what I mean?
There are certainly days where I'm like, this is not enjoyable what I am doing at this moment. But at the same time, I'm just kind of like,
it could be worse.
It could be so much worse.
Yes.
Like before this, I was making sandwiches.
This is better than that. Yeah, I would say this is better than that.
So I'm permanently in a state of, I just game the system. This ain't a job. Just, I trick someone.
Yeah, there's no question. I totally understand. I had a feeling, and that's not even my full-time job, so I'm with you 100% on that. It's kind of a good time to have you, and that's one of the reasons I asked, is that, you know, the Hawks have this very, very random 4-full-day break right now, where they don't play. It's the first time in my memory where they have 4 consecutive off days in a non-All-Star break setting.
I think it's affected a new schedule.
It is.
You're doing power rankings this season too, right?
I am, yes.
You noticed the weeks where teams play like only 2 games and how it's like really weird to like judge that week?
Yeah, 2 games schedules for a lot of teams. And like the craziest thing about this break for the Hawks is that it's in between home games. So there's not even any travel. Like they literally have 4 days at home. Chilling. I mean, they're obviously practicing, but it's just I've never seen anything like it. It's a product of the schedule, but they've also played exactly 20 games. So it's like, hey, why don't we talk about quarterly what happened? So there's been a lot of that, and this is going to be sort of. That's where we are. You know, they're 4-16, so it's not like it's breaking down the Warriors or the Rockets in terms of that kind of stuff. But there are some things to discuss as usual. One guy I wanted to ask you about, actually, is a guy you're familiar with from your days in Orlando, is Dwayne Dedmon. Dedmon's been very good. I would argue if he hasn't been the best player for the Hawks, he's been close. His numbers are really good. What have you seen from him, aside from the fact that he can somehow shoot now, which we should certainly talk about, because that's the headliner I was going to ask you just in general, like if you ever saw that coming, but just general takeaways from Dedmon, because I know you've seen a lot of him, and I'm not saying he's like blown away my expectations, but I think he's definitely been better than I thought he'd be.
Well, it's really difficult with a lot of the Hawks players, and Dedmon included, is just, I am a big proponent of on-off-court net rating and all that, but just, you look at the Hawks on off course, on offs, and it's just like, none of this is actually useful to me. Like, Dedmon has a negative 7.3 on-court net rating, which sounds like, oh, God, that's terrible, which that is terrible. But at the same time, it's like, doesn't matter. The entire team is bad.
Every single player that has, like, I think it's like 250 minutes, you probably have it in front of you, but every single player that's like, I would call like a lock rotation player, has a negative on rating this year for the Hawks, which is not a surprise when you're as bad as they've been. But it's not like there are guys that have these great net ratings. They don't really exist.
Right. There's no one on the team that's like going like, oh, they are actively having a positive impact on the game when they're on the floor, because just even the players that are playing well and are having a positive impact at times, like Dedmon, it just gets overshadowed by everything around them. So it's really difficult. So when you have players like Dedmon, who I agree, I think he's been one of the few bright spots in Atlanta right now. He's scoring, which is just weird. The shooting numbers are hilarious. Like, when I saw him first take a three-pointer, I was like, that's funny. That'll stop. And it hasn't.
I mean, it's not like he's taking great volume. Like, it's only 29 attempts, but 14 of 29 is wild.
28 more than he's taken his entire career.
Well, yes. I mean, it's obviously a big change. Like, we saw it in the preseason, and I asked about it. So to Michael Cunningham, the AJC, we're like, to really to him and Budenholzer, like, is this a thing or is this a preseason thing? And it was kind of like, no, this is, we want him to shoot that. And we're like, okay. And I kind of figured it would sort of go away. And again, it's only about one and a half attempts a game, but like he's shooting them fluidly. Like there's no hesitation at all. Like when he's open, it's going up and it looks good. Like I'm not, you know, he's not gonna shoot 48% for his career from three, I don't think, but like it doesn't look like a guy who doesn't shoot.
Not
like,
with that attitude.
It looks good. I mean, it's the thing. Like I said, it, the first time I ever saw it in the preseason, I was like, wow, that actually looked pretty good. And I kind of just shrugged it off. And I realized like, he can shoot. It's weird.
This is the weirdest part of it, though, is it's not just that he's shooting threes. Like, remember when Al Horford started shooting threes, and
yes.
It was kind of weird at first, but at the same time, I was like, no, this makes sense. He's been shooting long twos forever. He's always had some range. Like, him stepping back and shooting threes, just that logically made a little bit of sense. Deadman's never been a shooter of anything.
No.
If he wasn't shooting by the rim, it was like, what's he doing? Like, that was the only place he shot. So when he comes in this season and starts shooting threes, it's like, what? No, this doesn't make sense. This shouldn't be possible.
Even his mid-rangers, like, they look good. I mean, he shoots. I think the Hawks have probably told him, at least it feels that way, that they want him, they'd rather have him shooting threes than 18-footers, which is usually a good strategy. But yeah, I mean, they all look good. It's a really weird thing. Like, it's not like this is a huge weapon for him because they're not looking for it, but he certainly gives them some more space that they desperately need, honestly, offensively, because it's not, they're not really playing any like complete non-shooters, but in the same breath, like they don't have the knockdown guys either. They only have really the one knockdown shooter in Bellinelli, and that's kind of the list. But just having some bigs that can step out, you know, John Collins doesn't really have that yet. He's been shooting mid-rangers and with some reasonable effectiveness, but you know, Devin playing as much as he is and being, I would argue, still the best center on the team, really the best big man on the entire team, having that guy being able to step out a little bit is certainly helpful, and I sort of shudder to think what it would look like offensively if they didn't have that now. I don't know, it's weird.
My favorite thing about it is when they brought him in, it was this weird kind of odd fit where the Hawks already had a system, and then they brought in this guy that he didn't really fit the system they were really running. So I was like, oh, I wonder if they're going to change the system or whatever. Like, no, they made Deadman fit what they do, which that's really one of the cool things about it is they took this guy who had, like, a set skill set, a set idea of what he was, and they kind of morphed him into, no, we want him to be like this, and we think it's going to work, and it's working. And now Deadman, who at first just felt like, oh, he'll just be a placeholder gap while the team builds into whatever they're going to be, it's like, no, he's actually building, helping them build towards their future because they are having an established identity of a team they want to be.
Yeah, it's very weird. I mean, they clearly saw it. I mean, it wasn't like it's not from what I've heard from Bud, and they, it's not like they plan on this necessarily. Like, he's never going to admit to that, but they clearly saw something to where it was like, no, we're going to try this. Even before he came in, I think they saw, you know, I think he mentioned something about how they'd seen him in warmups. Like, it was, it's that kind of subtle thing where, like, clearly there was no game tape of Dwayne Dedman shooting jump shots, but they saw it and they were planning on it, and I'm sure they would have built on it if it wasn't working, but their early returns were good enough where they were like, yep, go ahead, Dwayne, get shots up. And you know, Bud likes that in general. They did a great job with guys in the past. You know, you mentioned Al Horford shooting threes, but even guys even more subtly than that, they've had guys that have really improved, like not from complete non-shooters like Dedman, but like, you know, Kent Bazemore was basically a non-shooter when he got here. Damari Carroll was famously a non-shooter when he got to Atlanta, and that was, you know, a career, you know, high 33-point shooter since then. So yeah, it's a little bit different with a pure center that doesn't really have that at all in his background. But you know, Bud's player development staff has always done a good job with that stuff. And it doesn't even look weird. Like Al Horford's jump shot is very unique. It's not like
it's like a catapult.
Yeah, but the thing is, like, if he didn't shoot well, people would try to mess with his jump shot. But he's always shot well, even when he was young. He was a really good mid range shooter, as you said. So nobody was gonna mess with it too much. Whereas Deadman, like, it looks like a jump shooter. Like, there's no weirdness. There's no. It's like a guy who would be 6'8" shooting instead of 7 feet. Like, it's jarring to see it just because of the fact that you would think, based on his resume, that he just has this really weird form where it takes forever to get off, and nope, it's just getting up immediately. It's wild.
Shouts to Atlanta for noticing that.
Yeah, I don't know how they did it. I mean, that's a credit to the front office and the player development staff. But yeah, I mean, aside from that, he's kind of been the guy that he's normally been. He's shooting 60% from the floor on pretty limited attempts, only about 8 a game. So it's not like he's getting a ton of shots up on the interior, but he's playing good defense. He's rebounding the ball well. You know, he's, again, I think been the brightest spot for the Hawks. You could argue Dennis Schroeder has been a better player just because Dennis does more offensively, all that fun stuff. Obviously, John Collins we'll talk about in a second. It's been a lot of fun. But I think Dedmon, in terms of the guys who are exceeding expectations, you know, non-rookie division would be my guy. I just think he's been anything they could have asked him to be and more, to be honest. I don't know. It's one of those things. We can move on from Dwayne Dedmon just because I know we could. He's not the sexiest player in the world to discuss, but it's. I just wanted to talk about it because like he's good, and I feel like, I mean, you wouldn't know this because it's every day on my show, but like it's one of those things where unless he shoots 8 of 8 from the floor in the game and has 18 points, it's like, all right, Dwayne Dedmon played well tonight. Moving on. So you know what I'm saying? Like he'll have 12 and 7, and it's like, yeah, Dedmon played well, and I'll spend 30 seconds on it. And that'll be the end of that. So just reflecting a little bit on the first 20 games, like, you know, his PER is really good. He's been very efficient. Like, I'm looking at his advanced numbers right now, like 18.4 PER, 66% true shooting. That's going to come down. But the rebound rate is up. His defensive rebounding rate has been huge. I think he's the only guy on the roster that has a big time minutes, has a plus, a more than 20% rebound rate, because that's not something the Hawks have been very good at this year. He's been crucial to all of that. So there you go. Dwayne Dedmon, the experience has been good. Let's talk about John Collins, because he's fun. And
I love John Collins.
It was not you that wrote it, but I think he landed number 5 in the CBS rookie rankings this week. I think that was Colin that wrote that over there.
That was my boy Colin. Shouts to Colin.
Yeah, and you know, he's been popping up on all these lists, and I talked with our mutual friend Jeff Siegel early on, I think it was last week, about sort of where he would go in a redraft, and we kind of landed somewhere in the back half of the top 10, and people were upset that we had him too low. It was that kind of thing. Like, Hawks fans are very excited. So I want to ask you, like, I know you say you love him, but what does that mean? Like, what do you think he's actually sort of is now and what he can be? Because that's sort of the divide. I think a lot of Hawks fans are like thinking he's an absolute star already, and I'm not sure I'm all the way there. It's definitely looking like an awesome pick at this point in time, but what does that actually mean to you?
I wouldn't go guaranteed star already, but just there's so much potential that you can see already from such a young player, and that's more than just the dunks. The dunks are obviously the most exciting part about it, but he's already pulling down rebounds. He's already just showing this knack for getting to the rim and placing himself where he needs to be, and just this offensive instinct that a lot of guys come in with, but they don't really understand how to use properly. It feels like he just gets it. It helps that he's on a team where, like, he can kind of make mistakes and no one's really going to notice or care. So that helps him a lot, because he's not on like a winning team where, no, he's going to get yanked if he makes that mistake, which that is very noticeable on the defensive end, which there's potential there, but he needs some work. I think he might lead the NBA in personal fouls, or he's close to it right now. He's definitely a bit of a fouler, which that's going to happen when you're young. And
that was always, by the way, I mean, even coming out of college, like, that was a concern. And early on, I think I might have jinxed it. I was talking about how it wasn't as big of a concern in the first few games as I thought it might be. And since then, he's been a machine when it comes to fouling. And you know, with the way that Bud treats it, I mean, it's effectively kept his minutes down, which could be a good thing in the short term. But, you know, a lot of the time, like, he's almost fouling himself out, because Bud's not going to just leave him out there with foul trouble a whole lot of the time, because of considering his youth and all that stuff. I'm not sure Bud trusts him just yet to play through that kind of stuff. But yeah, he fouls quite a bit. He's not shy, which I kind of like the way that he's not shy when it comes to like going after guys and protecting the rim and sort of flying around and using his body. He just has to learn how to channel it.
Right, which that's fine. Like, he's youngish, which that's good. You want this kind of skill set in him. You want him to be aggressive. You want him to not show any of that fear. That you don't want him to come in. To make a comparison, when Cody Zeller came to the NBA, he obviously is a different player because he came in a lot older, if I remember correctly. He spent the first few months of the NBA just terrified. One time, I think he caught the ball in the perimeter and just had no idea what to do with it. Like, deer in the headlights, just had no clue what to do with the ball. I never see that in John Collins. There's never a point where I see him on the court and go, he looks lost out there, which is fantastic. You don't want him to look lost out there. You want him to look comfortable. You want him to look like he understands what's going on. And that's progress enough, and that's success for Atlanta. Like, through the first quarter of the season, whatever you want to call it, you can say that John Collins, in Atlanta especially, but on most NBA teams, would be contributing in some factor, and that's great, at least on the offensive end. The defense needs work.
Yeah, that's probably a good way to put it.
But defensive rookies is just – it's nice when they're useful. Like, it's nice when you have Jonathan Isaac actually being a good defender immediately coming out of college, but that's so rare, and it rarely ever happens. Guys just don't understand defense.
No, and honestly, I've said this before, but I think he's been better than I thought. It's not, and I think people are a little excited because he is athletic and he's a good rebounder, and that can sort of mask a lot of stuff. There are certainly times when he is lost defensively, but he's a rookie, and like, rookies are generally bad defensively, especially guys that were bad at college defensively, and he was bad in college defensively. Like, he was bad. He's been much better in the NBA than he was in college, which doesn't happen for rookies. You're normally not suddenly better defensively unless it's just an effort thing, which part of it was in college. Like, you know, Ben Simmons just didn't try at LSU and now is trying and he's good defensively. But like, John Collins wasn't like purely an effort issue. It was like he was just bad and he fouled a lot. And, you know, a part of it was scheme stuff that Wake Forest, without getting too deep into it, that Wake was asking him to do. But, you know, Collins is, he's not terrible. And that's a huge thing because I thought he was going to be terrible as a rookie. And that doesn't mean he's going to be you know bad for his entire career. But the fact that he's been playable defensively is kind of huge because I think you'll see some big strides, I would imagine, from year one to year two. A lot of times that usually happens, especially when guys are coached well. And with Bud, who's famous for getting a lot out of his defensive pieces, that's probably going to be the case again. And we'll see a big jump from him. I'm still not sure he's ever going to be more than an average defender. But if he's an average defender, that'd be great. That's kind of all you need.
I think that's where kind of the divide kind of comes for how you kind of view John Collins' future. Is, well, I think he's going to be fine offensively. I think at worst he'll be a really good slashing attacker that can just kind of get to the rim and, you know, bruise around for about 20 minutes a game, which there's a lot of guys that do that successfully and do it well. How good he becomes is really going to depend on the defensive end, because there's a lot of guys where they're athletic and they know how to use athleticism, and we go, oh, this is great, he's going to become this really great defender. And then they never do, and it's like, why are they not a good defender? Some guys just, they're not good at defense. Like, that just happens, which maybe, I don't think that's what's going to happen to him, but that's certainly a possibility, which I think that's where the kind of the split that you were talking about earlier with how people kind of view Collins' future is, that's really where it's going to really happen is, is he going to turn into more than just say, oh, he's passable on defense, to an actually good defender? Because if he actually becomes a good defender, then sky's the limit for what he can actually be.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he's already very good at some stuff. And, yeah, definitely. I mean, his burst will slow down eventually, but he's so young that it's not going to be coming for a while. And he's an animal in the offensive glass. He's efficient already. His numbers are great. So, yeah, the sky's the limit there, and I'm excited as well. I think people are probably used to me downplaying it a little bit because I think, you know, some Hawks fans are getting carried away, but it's my job to tell them when they're getting carried away. And it's also my job to tell people to slow down when they're the other way too, like when they have, you know, hate for certain people. It's like, guys, calm down. The guys, he's fine, et cetera. And that's sort of playing out with Collins here. Yeah, the guy I wanted to ask you about was Dennis Schroeder, because weirdly, sort of like Deadman, I feel like I haven't talked a ton about Schroeder. I mean, there was one famous podcast that Jeff and I did where we kind of rail on his defense for about 20 minutes straight. but aside from that, like, it's sort of gotten into that thing where I've said almost all I can say about Dennis's defense. The effort's been bad all season. It's frustrating, but offensively, the numbers are good. He's been fairly efficient. I mean, he's not as efficient as he was a list, you know, super early in the year. He had a couple of bad games in a row, and that could sort of torpedo you after 20 games. But as an outsider, you know, we talked about Schroeder a couple months ago, you and I, on this podcast. Has anything changed in your mind with him? I know the role was not ideal with him having to be, you know, sort of everything offensively here, but what do you think about Schroeder now versus the past, and I guess toward the future as well?
I guess I just really don't feel that much different about him.
That's kind of what I am too.
he doesn't try on defense. Offensively, he guns like a mofo, which, cool, that gives him, someone's got to score on this team, so he's the guy to do that. That's fine, but just, he's efficient enough. I don't want to say he's an efficient player. I'd say he's efficient enough. I feel like he's just putting up numbers because he's the only guy that can kind of do that for them. there's nothing, I don't watch him and go, oh, he's definitely a piece they need for the future. I don't watch him and go, they can definitely rely on him. Like, his usage is 29.8% this year, which is just an absurd amount for a team that supposedly is supposed to be moving the ball and shooting threes, which I know this is a different team from what they've been in the past.
Yeah.
It's unfair to hold them to that kind of standard, but...
And him, too. I think it's important, like... some of it is him looking for his own stuff, but even last year
he's not as bad as he's not as bad as he used to be. He used to be horrifically bad with tunnel vision.
Yeah, and there are times when that comes back, and I think the usage rate is almost necessary. It could probably be a couple points lower just because I think he is, as you kind of said there, he still has the tendency to regress into that a little bit. But the Hawks also need him to do it. Someone has to try to score. That's the thing. Or it's not even always scoring. He's the only guy, and, you know, Bembry missed a lot of time. He's really the only other guy on the perimeter that, I mean, Bazemore's been trying to do more of it. His usage is up this year, and, you know, there are pros and cons to that, but at least he's trying to do it to have another secondary guy out there. But Schroeder is the only guy, and I've been saying that since the summer before the season even started. It was like, guys, look at the roster. He's it. I mean, Marco Bellinelli is going to shoot a lot and create for himself in that way, but Schroeder is the only guy who can really create for others. In a non-Bembry world. And, you know, Schroeder's passing is frustrating at times too, but, you know, the assists are there. Part of that's, again, usage, but I don't know. It's not like he's – offensively, I think he's been exactly what I thought he'd be, pretty much. Defensively is where it gets frustrating.
I feel like he's the same player from last year is the thing, which that's not bad.
That's what I think he is, though, and that's what I've always thought. Like, I know there's some upside there. He's still fairly young, but, you know, at a certain point when you're in year five, year six
– point guards do kind of have a – late jump. Let me look with Kemba and John Wall. And all. There was a year where, like, Kemba, John Wall, and Kyrie, they all had, like, incredible jumps at the exact same time.
Yeah, I mean, I think the Kemba comp, I mean, they're not similar.
I'm not making the comp. I'm more just being point guards in general. Where, like,
well, yeah, I just mean, like, with guys like Wall and Kyrie, the talent level's so high that it's, you kind of always knew it was coming at some point. I mean, those guys are number one overall picks. You know, Kemba, for a while there, looked like he was going to be a bust, like a flat-out, like, inefficient bust.
He was a gunner that couldn't shoot early on in his career.
Yeah, and I think Schroeder, I mean, if there's one thing that I've been impressed with Schroeder's maturation, is that he's become a better shooter every single year, basically. In some
shooter,
way.
Shooter, if you will?
Yeah, exactly. he's added something along the line in terms of his efficiency, and most of that is his jump shot, because as a finisher, he's still disappointing a little bit in that it's basically just speed layups. That's kind of all he does, which is okay. When you're that fast, you can get a lot of speed layups, but his jump shot's come a long way. It's not great, but he's now been a 35% three-point shooter for the last two full seasons at real volume, and a lot of those are contested, so, like, that's fine.
So I looked it up. At 26 years old, Kemba and John Wall both just kind of, like, took, like, jumps, like, just these really huge jumps for their careers, where it's like, oh, they look different this year. They look better than they've ever looked, and Schroeder's still 24, or did he turn 25 yet? I think he's 24.
24. He actually just turned 24 in September, so he's still a young 24.
Okay, so yeah, he's a young 24, so he still is trying to get better. Like, there's still those extra 2 years. And Atlanta's not going to be good enough in 2 years to where they can't, like, be like, oh, well, we can't wait on this. So they have time to be patient with him and see if he does get any better. I think we kind of want our point guards to be ready a lot quicker than they actually are a lot of the time. So there's still time for him. But right now, just last year and this year, they feel a lot of the same, which that's not a bad player. It's just you kind of wished you had seen some progress.
Yeah.
It's just the team.
Part of it's that. I do think, you know, I think Jeff and Graham, a couple guys that work with me over at Peachtree Hoops, and especially Jeff, are disappointed more than I am, I think, because they were projecting a little bit more growth than I was from Dennis. I kind of always thought he would be maybe a slightly better version of what we saw last year, but I've just never been that high on Dennis, to be honest with you.
Same.
It's one of those things where, like, Graham, who I've had on the podcast and writes a ton for us and does a great job, I think is always going to be lower on Dennis than I am. But at the same time, like, I think it's just an expectation thing. Like, I just kind of think this is what he is. And the numbers are inflated. Like, I don't think he's a guy who you would think would be averaging 20-7 in an actual system where he wasn't the only guy. But people are going to see that number, at least casual fans are going to see 20.7 assists and think, man, he's really good. And it's like, well, no. Like,
well, the, hey,
he's fine.
Averaging 20 points in the NBA is not easy.
No, and that's the thing. Like, he can score. Dennis Schroeder, that's the thing that he can do. He is a scorer. And that's fine, except for when down the line, I think it's all through a prism of down the line for the Hawks. Like, this year's team doesn't necessarily matter all that much. They're bad. We kind of all know that. But is Dennis Schroeder a guy who you can see being the point guard on a, you know, top four seed in the Eastern Conference moving forward, ideally?
It depends,
maybe.
It depends what is around him, because...
Right, it's all about role.
Because a decent-ish comparison, it's nowhere near the same, a decent-ish comparison I would go with would be Jeremy Lin, and the fact that Lin is definitely an offense-first point guard. He's all about attacking. This is how they're different. Lin's more about attacking the rim and creating fouls, while Schroeder's more about jump shots and scoring that way. But even so, they're definitely offense and score first. And I wouldn't say Lin is definitely a point guard you want to build around, but if you have an excellent small forward, an excellent power forward, and an excellent center, then sure, why would you not want Jeremy Lin out there score, like, head of steam, get to the rim and score, as long as you have a more creator-minded wing of some kind next to him, which I think that can be the same with Schroeder. I think Schroeder, long-term, at least how I see him now, is more of a player that's going to turn into a sixth man type where he comes off the bench and just goes out there and scores. But I think he can be a starter caliber player, and if he is, it's definitely going to be on a team where they ask him, like, okay, we just want you to go out there when you have the ball and gun and shoot and score and put up points, because our creation abilities are going to be with our small forward or with our power forward or whoever we have running the offense for us.
We're at the point now where I'd be fascinated to see what Dennis would look like in a system where he wasn't the primary option. Because last year, I guess Paul Millsap was the primary option, but at the end of the day, Schroeder's usage was still the highest on the team. He had the ball in his hands all the time. We've kind of seen this now. It's more magnified this year because there really isn't even a secondary primary option. Like, he's it. But I'd be fascinated just to have him, like, be dropped into a team that had maybe a ball-dominant wing or something like that, just to see what he even
put him on the
like.
Sixers.
Yeah, I mean,
put him on the Sixers,
that's
with,
even like a super case, obviously. But, like, even if there's just one, like, if he was the number two guy, I'd be interested to see what that even looked like. Would he be more efficient?
I don't know if he could play off ball.
That's the question. I don't know.
I know he kind of does in Atlanta, but, like, I feel like when he's off ball, this is one of my issues I do kind of have with him. When he's off ball in Atlanta, I feel like he's just not a threat. I feel like teams do not care.
And they don't. I think they probably should care a little bit more. His shooting is at the point now where it's not a situation where they have to care a whole lot about him, but they also just can't leave him by himself, if that makes sense. It's that limbo mode,
like,
where he's
going
to make enough shots.
I feel like the reason they don't care is more not because of his abilities to shoot or anything. It's because they know if he doesn't have the ball, he's not going to be involved in that play, because almost only involves himself when he has the ball.
That's true. And, you know, again, part of that, I'll try to defend him a little bit, is that when he doesn't have the ball in his hands, the guys who do have the ball generally aren't going to be good enough to create anything.
That's fair. That's,
I mean,
fair.
There are some guys, again, there are a couple of guys on this team that can get their own shot. Marco Bellinelli especially can get his own shot. And it's not necessarily super efficient, but he can be good at getting his own shot. And Bembry, now that he's back and healthy, can really create. And there's been some moments for Isaiah Taylor when he was healthy. Now he's not. He's been out for a while now, but they were playing some two-point guard stuff. If they really try to get some guys around him, they can sort of do that. But Dennis has never been, at least this is me talking, it has never seemed as if Dennis was thrilled when he was not on the ball. He's not the most active cutter. He's an okay shooter, but you have to have some more gravity than that, and he doesn't really play all that. I don't know. It's not all the craft. There's not a whole lot of craft in the way that he plays when he's off the ball. That makes sense. There are little ways to get yourself open to create more space for teammates. He doesn't really do that stuff when he's on the ball in his hands.
Right. He doesn't try to make himself a threat. He just kind of goes, stands there, and waits for the play to play out.
Yeah, that's right. And listen, he's fine. It's not. I'm not trying to pick on Dennis Schroeder. I think it's valuable, when I have people that are not Hawks people on, to just talk about him, because I think people get lost in the Hawks world. There's been a little bit of backlash this year to Dennis, I think more than I thought. But still, there's definitely a faction of the fan base that is going to just see the 20-7 and think, all right, there's a point guard of the future. And it's like, I'm not sure.
Yeah, I'm not trying to. When we're critically analyzing, I'm not trying to be like, oh, he's this terrible point guard.
For
like,
sure.
Third thing, I'm not a big Schroeder guy, but that doesn't mean I think he's a terrible point guard or anything. Like, he's not. I don't think he's not an NBA player. I don't think he's not even like a rotation level player. I think he's a starting caliber player, or at worst a sixth man, which that is not a bad thing. Like, I don't think he's someone you should build your team around, but again, that's not a criticism of him as a player. It's more just kind of the way it is, which that's fine.
And that's also, by the way, an appropriate contract for his entire prime. Like, you're getting ages 24 to 27, which is his prime. You would imagine that's most guys' primes, and you're paying him $16 million a year. That's what you get for that, is a low-end starter. That's what that is.
Right.
And, like, with some upside, I mean, I think he's, you know, as much as I just said, I kind of think this is kind of what he is. He's young enough where you could see the jump. Not a huge one. I don't think he's suddenly going to be a top 10 point guard. That ship has kind of sailed for me. But I do think he could be better than he is now. And if he's better than he is now, then he's probably a slight value on a contract. Like, right now, I think it's probably pretty neutral, maybe a little bit value because he's so young, and there's less risk in that of him just like falling off a cliff. And he's not really been injured at any point. Like, he's had little injuries, but nothing serious. So there's some value in that as well. But yeah, I just think it's fine. Like, I think you don't love it. If he's your best player, you're in trouble. We kind of all know that. We kind of knew that coming into the season. But if he's a central option, you're going to be what the Hawks general. I mean, last year we saw it. He led the team in usage. That was a playoff team. It was a bad playoff team, but they made the playoffs, and he had like
you were adamant about that.
Well, I mean, they had the worst net rating in the playoffs. They really weren't overly competitive in the first round. Like, but that was a playoff team. Listen, I mean, Paul Millsap's obviously the best player on that team by a wide margin, but Dennis Schroeder was really the number one option offensively for a lot of that season, and they made the playoffs. Okay. Part of that's just Mike Budenholzer doing Budenholzer stuff and Paul Millsap being awesome, but still, I mean, it happened. So
I'm so sad Millsap's hurt.
Yeah, that's brutal. I haven't talked about it on the podcast, but yeah, Paul being out for, was it 3 months?
That's the expected. That's the report great, from the Vertical or whatever, yeah.
It made me sad because I love Paul unconditionally. But yeah, it's not fun, and I feel bad. I feel a little worse for him now too, because I mean, this is still a year off, but I want him to get more money, and he's only got 2 years on this contract. There's only one more after this, and this is going to be basically a lost year if he's out for 3 months. Like, it's kind of brutal. He's getting his money, but I want him to still be good, and we'll see.
There's a chance that they could still be in playoff position when he comes back.
Yeah, and I think he'll be around. It's just, yeah, especially because if there's anything, it's kind of funny. They might be better offensively without him, which is wild to consider just because they run through everything through Jokic when he's not playing. But this is not the Locked On Nuggets podcast. But shouts to Adam Morris, though, by the way. Go listen to that podcast because Adam's the man. If you want to hear about Paul Millsap talk, go do that. But yeah, there you go, Paul Millsap.
You sound so sad. You're like, I can't talk about Paul Millsap anymore.
It does make me sad. I like Paul. That's my guy forever. So anyway, well, Chris, I've kept you too long, man. When we're both working, I know you're working as well. But anything you want to get out there that we haven't talked about yet, Hawks or otherwise?
Yo, why were they down 45 to the Raptors?
I can tell you that with some confidence that, you know, Toronto shot very, very well in that first half, and the Hawks just had no plan. Toronto actually sneakily, impressively came out and were switching literally everything, and the Hawks weren't prepared for it. It seemed that was pretty clear, and Bud tried to remedy that by going to Bellinelli to start the second half. The game was already over at that point. They were down by 30, basically. But yeah, it was a perfect storm of the Hawks just playing their worst game in a long time, and Toronto made every shot in the first half. It was just what it was.
When I was doing power rankings, I had to drop into the last place because of that. I was just like, NBA teams should not be down 45 to anybody. Like, I don't care. Just
yeah, that's it's reasonable.
This is a 1 week thing, but that's how I feel right now.
It was a weird thing. They played probably their best three quarter stretch of the entire season against the Knicks the night before. They got down 15 to the Knicks in the first quarter, and then ended up winning by 12. Like, they just thumped the Knicks for three quarters, and then they came out and played their worst game of the season the next night at home. It was like, all right,
happens.
It was very Hawks. Like, people were kind of excited about Friday. It's like, oh, the Hawks played well tonight. You know, things are they're playing better in general. And I will back that up. They actually were playing better in general.
They are one of the more competitive bad teams.
Well, yeah, that was their first blowout loss of the season. I said on the podcast yesterday, I was like, look, they had a couple of games that weren't in doubt in the final minutes, but like, they weren't just getting, you know, blitzed uncontrollably. There was their first time all year that they absolutely just got lambasted. And that's not bad. And you know, game 20, when you're a bad team, you're usually going to get blown out more than that. They've been pretty competitive.
Yeah, and that's actually one of the things I actually really like about the bad teams this year is there are a few, very few bad teams that I think are just horrendously bad. Aside from the Bulls, there's no one that I just think is so painfully bad that I expect them to lose by 15 or more every single night. That is the only team that I feel is that bad. Everyone has been, for the most part, even Dallas has been, for the most part, competitive.
Yeah, the old, I think number two would be Sacramento.
They're pretty bad. They are sneakily really bad.
It's weird with them because they, and I mean, I picked the Bulls to finish last. I think I'm going to be right about that. That's my guess coming into the year. But the Kings are worse than
I thought. The Bulls lost a game where the Heat only scored 7 points in a quarter because the Bulls scored 13 that quarter.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
That is so impressively bad.
Well, the Kings lost by 46 to the Hawks, which is the worst loss of the season by anybody. and that's not necessarily indicative because I actually think Sacramento's roster is better than Atlanta's roster, top to bottom, pure talent wise. You know, there's
it
the
is,
Hawks have more like established veteranish players, whereas the Kings have more young guys.
But the Hawks actually run a system while the Kings play
like
2002.
Right. That's the difference between the Hawks and the Kings is that the Hawks are competitive every night because they have a plan, and the Kings don't really.
But what's funny about the Kings is early in the season they would actually win a game every once in a while, they had four wins a lot faster than the Hawks did.
Yes.
But their advanced ratings were just horrendously awful. Which
that's a 46-point loss. they're bad. The Hawks are better than those two teams. They could certainly make it to where they're not if they made a few trades. Like if they were to trade Dwayne Dedmon, who is the obvious trade candidate. That would hurt them quite a bit if the Hawks did that in the coming days, and if that happens...
Is he the obvious trade candidate?
I mean, he's the only guy that has real value.
But should they be making should they even be making trades?
Well, here's the thing, and we could sort of end on this. I think Dedmon is interesting because he has a player option for next year that if he plays like this the rest of the season, he's not picking up player options, so he'll be a free agent. And if you're the Hawks... you have to at least look at trading him just because I think everybody that's not under contract long-term, he's not that young. I mean, he was an older college guy. Like, he's not super young. I wouldn't like give him away. I'm not saying they have to trade him, but with full knowledge that listen, I think he's going to decline that player option. Do you want to have him be hitting free agency and you didn't get anything for him?
I guess, but at the same time, I don't feel like anyone's going to give you a young future piece or a draft pick that's valuable for him.
You would need somebody to get desperate. Like, you would need an injury to a contender. Because the one thing about Dedmon is that
I don't think he's that good.
I don't think he's that good, but I think it's a spot where he actually can function against those teams. Like, he can be on the floor against... I mean, the Warriors are another beast altogether, but like, he could be on the floor against the Rockets. Like, he could be on the floor against these teams. Like, especially if he's going to shoot at a reasonable clip, like he certainly now is. I'm not saying he's going to game change anybody. Like, he would need you. I think you're right. Like, you would need an injury to somebody that needs. Like, for instance, the Celtics might want to go all in a little bit.
I can see them they want to make a depth decision of some kind. So
he's better than Aaron Baines. Like, full stop. So like, and they've been linked to some centers in the past. I'm just picking out a team out of nowhere, and they have some assets. Like, they have a couple of these like super late first round picks that might be interesting, that kind of stuff.
Oh my god, he's gonna get traded to the Sixers for Okafor.
That's not gonna happen. I don't think. Unless here's this. If Philly wants to trade a draft pick in that deal, then sign me up.
Actually, no, they're not gonna do that because Okafor, because the Sixers are stupid and refuse to get rid of Okafor, and everyone knows they don't want him. So
he has no value at all.
They're just waiting for him to hit free agency.
They have systematically tanked his value for months and months and months.
That is, it's if you want me to rant for 20 minutes, just ask me about Jahlil Okafor. Oh my god, that whole situation angers me.
Another day. But yeah, all that to say, like, this Hawks team is what this Hawks team is. I think they could. They'll be better if they keep everybody the rest of the season. They're going to play at a higher level later than they are now because they have young guys and they're well coached.
They'll probably win 25 games.
Yeah, I mean, they're on pace. I think I picked them for 26 coming into the year. So you have to go a little bit less than that now because they've played under that pace. I'd probably go somewhere in the neighborhood of 23 to 24, somewhere in there. But, you know, they could certainly win more than that if they kept everybody in. If Collins comes on, they start playing him more, and, you know, Schroeder, and they get Memory back, all that fun stuff. They could also win 17 if they sold off some pieces here and had an injury or two. So
I feel like the bad teams are going to be really, really bad this year. I think them, Dallas, Sacramento, and Chicago are just going to be in a race for just some truly putrid records.
Yeah, I mean, Chicago, I'd be surprised now if they win 20. I was not fully on that train until
I like Markkanen, and Levine is coming back. Not that I think Chicago's any good. I think they're awful, but
yeah, we'll see. Everybody has a little bit of optimism. You know, Sacramento has all the young guys. Chicago can at least say for a little while longer, like, look, Zach LaVine's back. He's going to be our best player. Like, I'm not sure I see that all happening, but they at least have a little bit of optimism. The Hawks have the youth, and they're trying hard. Yeah, that's all I got.
Yay effort.
Yeah, A for effort. Well, thank you, sir, for coming on the podcast. As always, it's been too long. I will wait less than whatever it was, 6 weeks since I had you on last time. That'll be shorter this time around, because I appreciate your ministry coming on here.
I hope I gave as much effort as the Hawks do.
They do give effort, and you did as well, sir. So please follow Chris on the Twitter. You are at Chris Barnwall, correct?
Yes, I am.
And CBS Sports. Go read CBS Sports. Matt wrote a great thing, by the way. I was reading this before we started talking. Matt Moore, who is plugged in a great degree in Memphis, wrote about the Memphis situation, and David Fisdale. Check that out. If you like the NBA in general, Matt wrote a good thing. So check that out. Right before I started recording this, I was reading it. So that was a weird thing. By the way, I immediately got three different people asking about Fisdale replacing Budenholzer. So there's
that. Oh my God.
Not now, but like there's this assumption that Bud's going to get fired, which I don't subscribe to. It's like, hey, if Bud gets fired, could they hire David Fisdale? I'm like, yeah, they could. If Bud got fired, which I don't really see that happening, but maybe.
If he got fired, I would have major concerns about this front office, because that would just be amazingly short-sighted.
Yeah, my long standing stance has been Bud may not be around after this year, but if that happens, it will be because he doesn't want to be. They're not going to just fire Budenholzer, I don't think. I'd be pretty surprised if Travis Schlenk was like, you know what, Bud, you're firing you.
There's one way I can see that happening is the new ownership / GM group kind of goes, you know, we didn't really get to pick our coach, so we want to pick it this time, and we want to say goodbye to Budenholzer because we like this guy, which that'd be incredibly meddlesome, and I don't think that would be a very good thing at all, but that's the only way I really see it happening right now, because I don't think they're going to have these expectations of, well, how could you not win games with this terrible roster that we gave you?
Right, that was my whole thing. It's like, I think Schlenk has to understand that he has at least an average, if not above average, NBA coach right now with Budenholzer. Like, he was a coach of the year for a reason. It wasn't one of those coach of the year awards where you can just get rewarded for having a roster that got better. Like, he earned the heck out of that coach of the year award. Like, he's a good basketball coach. I think Schlenk knows that. They may not see eye to eye because it's that super weird situation where Bud had power and then no longer has power. It's just a very weird dynamic, and that leads to the questions, which I definitely understand because it's so not normal that a guy would be the GM and then be retained, but then suddenly not be the GM anymore. So I get it. It's just something to keep an eye on. But all that to say, that was a weird situation that I know you covered quite a bit this evening. So there you go. Well, thank you, sir. We've rambled on too long, but I appreciate you coming on, and we'll have to have you back very, very soon.
Catch you later.
As for everybody else, stay tuned for tomorrow's podcast. We'll be back with another guest. I hope that's scheduled. Hope that comes through. And if nothing else, we'll see you tomorrow.